don't know, a couple inches.
Hey. It's
embarrassing.
What?
Oh gosh, it was recording the whole time.
Are you laughing at me?
Yeah, yeah, a little, you and your couple of inches.
Chelsea's putting the Easton machine on my back.
Whatever you guys call it, Mildness.
Fine.
The following is a Mediocre Movie Club production.
Welcome back to the Mediocre Movie Club podcast. I'm John Kissel, and with me tonight to discuss the HBO series Rome is Shane Settner.
Yo.
Bobby Schmidt.
Hello.
And Brian Hartman.
That's me.
Why did you throw in Bobby right there and just break up the ambulators?
What's to be said?
I guess, Bobby, would you like to be an ambulator with us?
Why?
You sound like a Seth Bullock to our A.W. Merricks. You don't quite see them. You don't quite see the purpose in clubs joining groups.
I don't.
Okay, that's fair.
Good.
Well, I mean,
off to a great start.
If what the ambulators do is talk about very old HBO series, how important or how relevant is our recruiting process, anyways?
Yeah,
we don't know, listeners to the Media Weaver Club podcast. You know, you come to us to hear about what have we been watching. Whatever has come up in our latest trio of movies. We don't know if you want to hear us talk about Rome, a series that last aired in 2007. But hey, let's find out.
More we had so a great time. Do they want to hear us talk about The Wire? So.
Well, maybe they did. I mean, the letters I got, Bobby, from people wanting to know what happened in the second half of season one of The Wire, it wasn't zero.
Yeah,
it wasn't two either, though.
Just one letter written in crayon.
It was.
I noticed some of Jeff's were missing.
Yeah, well, you know, peach doesn't taste like peach. Let's just say that. So Rome is like HBO's big period set piece drama after Deadwood wrapped up. Occupies an interesting period in their history. Before Game of Thrones, Sopranos is wrapping up. Yeah, it just didn't really work out. It ended after two seasons. Very expensive. Never caught on like they hoped it would. I was looking at their ratings on Wikipedia, and they stopped keeping track at the end of the second season. It just really dumped it. It's notable for, I don't know, not really a lot. I don't feel like its legacy is too significant.
I think its biggest legacy is being the thing they cut so they could start filming Game of Thrones.
I don't know. I need
thought
to.
That was an actual thing. There's like
maybe.
Yeah,
I feel like I feel like they would have. Well, they couldn't have done both just because it like the critical reaction, which you know was positive, but as far as Emmys are concerned, it doesn't dominate like Sopranos did. I feel like they were gonna cancel it anyways, and like
I don't think it had anything to do with directly with Game of Thrones. It's just cost wise and their deal with BBC and. Money, right? That's really what it is.
Yeah, this ended in 2007 in Game of Thrones. They probably filmed that first pilot in like 2010, and then they had to go back and reshoot it. So, there was a lot of time separating these two things. But even though I don't feel like it has a big cultural footprint, like Brian, to expand on the place that Rome occupies in the continuing golden age of television, like how familiar would you have been with this show if we weren't discussing and recapping it on the podcast for the last, call it, 8 months?
As familiar as I am with every other HBO TV show.
Which is to say...
zero. I did know this was a thing, so that's all it's got going for it.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, I think that speaks for itself. So you've never seen this before. Shane, what's your background with this?
I believe I've seen it three times.
Did you watch it when it aired?
I did not. No, I did not. No idea, but this is right up my alley.
Okay. Bobby?
I watched it when it aired, and I have not revisited it since. And my only memory of it seems to be Lucius and Pulo. Because everything else, I'm like, don't remember that.
I watched it when it came out. It was appointment television back when the VCRs were still a thing. I would record it every weekend or every Sunday during fraternity meetings and then race upstairs to watch.
You didn't skip meetings like CJ, Carl, and I would for the city.
What?
Yeah.
Yeah. That is disgraceful. That is disgraceful, sir.
That was, you know, one of the few times where I'm like, that's not my friend. I don't know that man.
I mean, are CJ and Mr. Epperson okay with you putting that information out into the wide public that listens to the Media Community Club podcast?
It was Carl, so.
Carl, excuse me. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. CJ probably wouldn't care. I don't know about Carl.
Well, we'll find out because I know that he listens.
Well,
maybe you'll get another letter.
Yeah.
Sweet. All right. This one will be written in colored pencil. So let's just dive right into it. We're not necessarily going to like go beat by beat through the series, talk about each individual plot point, because this is a dense series that covers a wide swath of history.
And let me ask you a question, since you bring that up, as someone who's watched what is seemingly all TV. Do you feel like one of its fatal flaws was its density? Like, has there been a more dense show since Rome?
I think, like, the average TV viewer, let's not say the average TV viewer, like the hardcore TV viewer that I think most networks are really going for, the kind that these days discusses things on Reddit and back in 2006, 2007 on like discussion boards. I think that this show was right up their alley. I think like Lost was going on at the exact same time. And that's a show that was, you know, it had like 10 times the success of Rome and the viewing numbers of Rome. And people were still poring over every single minute detail. I don't necessarily think that was, I don't really have a sense of it. I honestly have no idea why this show wasn't more popular than it was.
Does Lost have more stuff to keep track of, or the same, less?
I could not speak to that.
I mean, there's a lot going on at Lost, and the mystery of it all was primarily what drove it. And some, you know, some well-written characters, at least initially, some interesting characters. But Rome is just kind of like, okay, we know what's going to happen to see, right?
Yeah.
So we got to get there. And they didn't really take their time getting places here. Like, as we're talking about in time with this.
Yes, we're going to have a recurring segment every week called, and hopefully we can beat it, but just knowing our track record, we probably will not. The segment will be called Time Makes No Sense in Rome. And it's something that we can revisit every week because it doesn't. The entire series takes place over a 30-year period, which is crazy, which is an absurd amount of time, and they don't even bother to age the characters. There's just these historical signposts that they hit that take a tremendous amount of time. At one point, they exchange one actor for an older actor, but it's the difference between like an 18-year-old and a 24-year-old, not an 18-year-old and someone in his mid-40s, which is more accurate. But I don't think there's like a comparable example of another historical series like this that really broke out in the last or in the 21st century of television. Like the most popular shows are things like The Sopranos. Well, I guess Mad Men would count, but even Mad Men takes place in a recognizable like American reality. Like another,
this is, I think, the big comparison to this at the similar time frames and like with the gratuitous, you know, violence and fighting and nudity. This was kind of the comparison to that, but Spartacus didn't have as much to learn or, you know, yeah.
That's a very straightforward, and it also has very straightforward appeals with how like hard, like that show is essentially a hardcore porn in various instances. I feel like that draws enough people in like that. And I mean, and that being said, like that show was really about stuff as well. And,
are you talking about Spartacus the movie?
No.
Exactly. I mean, like the Stars series.
Oh, I didn't know that was a thing.
Like, exactly. Like Stars, just the what you would call a success on Stars is a lot less than what you would call a success on HBO. Like there are an equal of Party Down episodes as there are of Rome episodes, and Party Down never crossed like the 100,000 viewer mark. Whereas Rome was, you know, notching several million per episode.
I feel like Spartacus did all right, and maybe that's just relative, but yeah.
First thing about Rome, you can see where all the money went. the first season aired in 2006. I was a senior at U of E, University of Evansville, and I was wrapping up my history minor. And that semester, I happened to be taking a Roman history class that was required of all history majors and minors, taught by Dr. Kaiser. And like we would talk about this show every Monday after class. And he had nothing but derision for the characterization and the timeline. But as far as the production design and the tone and like the costuming and the cuisine and the graffiti, nothing but praise.
And that's like a very archaeologist critique of the show, I feel like. History of people, we can flop it up a little bit.
And I think Kaiser was an archaeological guy first and foremost. He was just like the history department was borrowing him.
Yes, you know, a lot of memorization.
Yeah, it wasn't.
In my archaeology
terrible,
classes,
terrible textbooks.
Copied off of Jay Beckham or JB.
I mean, it's out there now.
JB and Jay Beckham are far different. So,
yeah. I love. I feel authentic. You know, not that I know what the fuck I'm talking about. I used to think Braveheart was authentic, but it feels pretty authentic. Like some of the stuff looks goofy to the point where I'm like, okay, that had to be done intentionally.
For instance.
Some of the outfits, like.
By the way, we're talking about the first three episodes of the first season: "The Stolen Eagle," "How Titus Pillow Brought Down the Republic," and "An Owl in a Thorn Bush." Available on Amazon Prime and HBO Now.
Yeah. So, I would say her henchmen that she hires, the security.
Yeah.
When they get down, like the little silly outfit he wears.
Oh,
when they're
cool.
About to get down.
Yeah, he's wearing like a harness or something.
Yeah, like I'm like
sure.
Ahead
of that sounds fine.
So that was probably a thing. I assume.
Why not?
She was. You know, his domina, and I guess he was going for that kind of role.
He is in complete thrall to her, so she just likes the harness, I assume.
Yeah.
It keeps his tits from like flopping around too much.
Yeah, that could be it. Yeah. Or I guess if you're going to have like another servant watching you bang, or multiple servants watching.
Many
you bang,
servants.
Many servants.
Many servants.
Might as well wear something maybe one of the X-Men would wear.
The next guy comes in with like a Rome style Cyclops visor.
He's making the sound effects. Like, this makes no
Please
sense.
Please stop that. Stop that. Yes, Domina.
And he's like, I'm Cyclops. Oh, that makes sense because he's one of our demigods.
Sure, yeah. They all know the story of Cyclops. Not as many eye lasers in the Odyssey. as in Stan Lee comics. So, Brian, you have in our notes several period details that you wanted to praise.
Yeah, so when we're talking, the funniest thing is that they make penis jokes and there's penis graffiti all over the place. Like, I don't know if that's a thing or it's just
very much so.
Like, yes, for how many thousands of years has drawing a penis been hilarious? Because the tradition still continues today.
I'd be curious about those cave paintings in France that are like
right.
The earliest known records of human art.
Right.
I guarantee like it's just like buffalo, giant dick.
Yeah. No, it's buffalo, and then the next family comes in and the kids are over there just scribbling.
Yeah. Actually, I just read something earlier. One of the earliest drawings that we were trying to decipher it. And they just found out in the past 2 years that it was just like so and so fucked a girl here.
It's the equivalent of a toilet stall.
Basically.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So
it's a good time call. Og.
It adds a little comedy to an otherwise. Very serious show. I appreciated the guy that was like keeping time with
the calendar.
The calendar guy. I'm gonna assume that was real because that looked awesome.
I have the privilege of owning Rome as a physical media, and you know that's a great investment because if anything, this is a burgeoning part of the economy that's only going to continue to crank out plastic discs. For people to clog on their bookshelves. But one of the benefits, in addition to showing people, you know, what you own, is that you get all these fun little extras. And one of the extras in Rome is a historical companion that, like, pops text up on the screen as you're watching. And
you mean like companion discommanding. Not like you don't have some guy who just comes in. Yes. I thought I heard the dogs barking last
with
night.
Every,
nah, it has nothing to do with
another example. Yeah. Another example of the lack of success with HBO's Rome is that they only sold it. They didn't sell very many copies of the DVDs to the point where, for every region of the country, if you call a number that is like included in the DVDs, a guy will just come to your house while you're watching.
Majors are harder for jobs.
Yeah.
And they'll nudge you while you're watching. It's like, hey, you know that calendar? That's recreated from something they found like at an archaeological site.
You have one historical companion watch this show with you. Who would it be? Like anyone from history? Who would you watch this show with? Going to Abe Lincoln?
He's so humorless.
Yeah, I'd like to see how his is going. This, how his reactions would be.
I don't think he would react well to all the penises on the walls.
I'd be like, well, I guess I wasted that one. I could have gone. There's a lot of people that could have gone.
Just stop crying about your dead children, Abe. Yeah. And let's watch this TV show together. You're so sad.
Yeah. I can't even see around his hat. That's the worst part. It was a stupid choice.
Where does he sit in front? Well, there's so many chairs.
I don't know
theater
why.
Seating in here. Why are you? Terrible, terrible decision.
But Abe likes to sit front and back. I don't know. That's how we bathe each other.
I always knew. I mean, the rumors are true about Lincoln. I knew it.
He was sleeping with a man 200 years in the future.
Those are the rumors. Yeah, this is what we're referring to. Moving along from our nonsense and the production design of the show, getting into more of the cast of characters, there's just so many various factions. Again, the show is very Game of Thrones-ish, although it does, you know, take place in a facsimile of whatever happened in the first century BC. Who really knows? Nobody knows. First faction, you've got Caesar and Antony. They're wrapping up their conquest of Gaul. And when I say conquest, I mean their genocide. Like one of the handy historical companion notes is that like 1 million people died over the course of this 8-year war in the first century BC in unsettled Gaul, which is like northern Italy, modern day France, that area. So 1 million people in an underdeveloped region. You really got to hunt to find that number, and another 1 million sold into slavery. So conquering heroes returning, and this is something that we're going to come back to. In another segment where we talk about what they value and what they don't value and just the level of cruelty that exists in the world. But we'll put a pin in that and come back to it. So our Caesar, played by Kieran Hines, who, you know, eventually, again, we'll see in Game of Thrones briefly in an undercast role. And Mark Antony, played by James Purfoy, who I regret that we never saw in Game of Thrones. I feel like he would have been a great addition. Like, yeah, Euron Greyjoy, that's your Euron Greyjoy.
Yeah, he would be great at that. I mean, I love the guy who does Euron Greyjoy, but yeah.
While we're talking about these guys, can we talk about how great their haircuts are? And just
they're the same. They're the identical haircut. Yeah, yeah.
Every man has the same haircut, the pretty same much. Awful haircut. Yeah,
that's the style.
Yeah, it's 1998 white dude in the Midwest haircut right there.
Yeah.
Everyone copied off George Clooney and got that same haircut.
I mean, it is a Caesar haircut.
Yeah.
They're eating Caesar salads. They gamble at Caesar's.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
he's a very self-absorbed person. Everything about him has to be relevant to his legacy.
Just eat a salad, man. You Cobb salad, dude.
Try a Waldorf.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Jesus.
Mix it up. Under Caesar and Antony are common men amongst these aristocrats and patricians are Lucius Verinus and Titus Pullo. Proud members of the 13th. Verinus is a centurion, essentially a captain, and Pullo is just a grunt. They have like an odd couple friendship where Verinus is the stern and stoic one, and Pullo is the lively, vivacious, whorehouse patronizing one. They have a great chemistry, Kevin McKidd and Ray Stevenson. I think Brian mentioned how serious and stern he found the show. I think it's pretty funny in these first three episodes. I think Antony is consistently funny with his zest for life. I think Pullo is funny in more or less the same way. And how different of a language Verinus and Pullo have in how they approach the world, and how, especially in relation to women, like Verinus has been away from his wife, Niobe, for a very long time, another actress that showed up in Game of Thrones, and Pullo just trying to teach him how to talk to people I think all those scenes are very funny.
Wait, the late, I knew that lady showed up in something else. What is she in Game of Thrones? I've been trying to think about that all day. Yeah. There it is. Thank you. I feel much better now. Okay.
I think so. The Varinus and Pulo are actually two.
They're real. Yeah.
They're the actual real people that we know nothing about other than they won. They actually did get those awards or got the noted, like some sort of notice.
Yes.
After a battle.
And Caesar kept them, records, right? During his Gallic Wars, and he mentions them at one point.
And that's it.
Yes. And they like blow them up. Yes. In the midst of the genocide, two soldiers distinguish themselves in the middle of it. So think of them as SS soldiers that Hitler patted on the back. And it's like, you guys are killing it out there. Everybody buys their dynamic. It's not like annoying or overly familiar. Like it's just such a classic mixing of two personalities. But it works for everybody.
I think dynamic. It's fine. I'm not highly vested in those two. I think it falls into the time thing. Like it's just like they're magically the best buddy duo riding around on horses.
Right. They're just kind of victim of circumstance where they're stuck together. I mean, they're not people who would normally seek each other out and have any kind of relationship, but just as things happened, and they're amusing to watch.
Yeah, there are Forrest Gumps of the world. They find themselves at these nexes of history in
Nexi.
Nexi, sure, that works. That's even better.
If we're gonna go into Latin, it would be Next A, ending in AE there, maybe.
Love it. We're getting we're getting closer to the true word, I think. They're at the next A of these historical events, kind of just bumbling into them, like the second episode, as we mentioned, is titled How Titus Pullo Brought Down the Republic, where he prevents Mark Antony from getting to the Senate to prevent Caesar from being named an enemy of the state, which is what prompts him. What forces him to come to Rome and cross the Rubicon. I mean, that's just over a gambling debt that some drunken soldier in the 13th had with another drunken soldier. But as far as the show is concerned, that's just what causes the wheels of history to grind ever forward. Back in Rome, we get to like the high society part of the show with the Julii, Caesar's family. His niece, Attia, played by Polly Walker, as like this very politically minded, transactional matriarch of the family. And her son, probably one of my favorite historical figures, even a spoiler for history, he's eventually going to, you know, rule the world. And we can pretty much lay a good chunk of Western civilization at his feet. So thank you, Octavian Augustus, for that. And like Octavia, his older sister, these first three episodes is dedicated to her, like marital issues, her mom, Attia, forcing a divorce, trying to hook her up, Pompey, who we'll talk about shortly, that failing, her going back to her ex, and that ending badly with Attia having him killed at the end of these three episodes. Again, it's just the very strange morality where, as far as like if a Roman sat down and watched this show, Attia is the good guy and Octavia is the moron in this situation.
But Octavia is like one of the most well-known names from history, like women-wise.
Attia is like revered as a proper Roman woman, at least in the times, like it just at the time that Octavian was alive. But yes, Octavia, I mean, things are going to be okay for her as the series goes on. Like she's going to find herself doing the best a noble Roman woman can in these situations, which is finding herself married to the right people. And yeah, like she's like of those first emperors. Yeah. Like she's going to play a big role. But at this moment, she's very much the whiny teenager.
She has some legitimate gripes.
No question. No question.
Her mother makes her divorce her husband. And
then his blackened corpse shows up on their
have sex with a 50-year-old man.
Not rivals to the Julii at this point, but kind of like frosty friends, I would say. Like the kind of family that kisses them on the cheek and then maybe talks about them a little bit behind their back are the Junii, an ancient Roman family who are revered for having Lucius Junius Brutus in their ancestry, the man who killed the last Roman king. They're represented by Brutus and Servilia, his mother. Brutus being portrayed as kind of like a young, good for nothing nobleman who thinks very highly of himself, and Servilia, who think family even higher. They're both just very old timey aristocracy.
Brutus is another Game of Thrones person.
Another Game of Thrones, absolutely. Yeah, he played Edmure Tully. That's right. And here he's, I think he plays his part very well. He's recognizable classic character again with like a Hamlet-esque type who doesn't, you know, knows he should do something, doesn't know what it needs to be. His family legacy is obviously politics, and he doesn't really care for politics. And Servilia also, it's revealed that she has like a long time affair with Caesar, or in this case, a long time correspondence because he's been away for 8 years. And we'll just see where things go from there.
Yeah, can we talk about how hard it is to keep track of all this the first time you're watching this show?
I totally understand that. Yeah, especially if you have no sense of history, which I'm sympathetic to.
I have some sense from taking 3 years of Latin, but I mean, I've had to, half of my notes are talking about who is hanging out with who, just so I can keep everything straight.
Do you find like everyone is like physically distinguishable at least?
A little bit, but it's...
You mentioned the haircuts already.
The haircuts are all the same. The outfits are all mostly the same. The only guy that stands out is Cato, because he's always squirreling around hunchback.
Yeah, Cato falls into our next category of characters, Pompey and the Optimates. The Optimates being the people that want things the way they are, the conservatives. And their foes are the populares, represented by Caesar at this moment. But this is like a battle that's been going on for like 100 years, these two political factions in Rome. Cato leads the Optimates, and I hate his face. The I actor that plays him.
Had a stroke.
No kidding. Like every scene that he's in, he's got one eye squinted shut and the other eye bulging out of his head. I can't. I don't know what that's about.
I think he probably, I would put money on that guy had a stroke.
Maybe. It's worth looking into.
I think that's just part of how the character is supposed to come across, too, though. Like,
crotchety and...
Yeah.
Stroked out?
Yeah. Blood leaking in his brain.
Let's do that casting. All right. All right.
Hold on.
You're here to try out for the part of Cato. What do you got? I do have a British accent, and we are doing
And
everything.
I smell toast.
I smell toast.
Well, I don't know what that has to do with anything, but one side of your face no longer works. Go on.
Go on.
I told you. All right, so this is a good time to bring this up. For since we just got done with Deadwood, like Deadwood does a good job of, there's like one or two good-looking characters, and everybody else is either normal or ugly. Rome is full of beautifully well-kept people, perfectly shaven, and then there's Cato. And so I appreciate that he's the ugly guy in town.
Isn't that just kind of the stereotypical vision that people have of Rome, though, because of, I don't know, media, I guess. But that's what you think of when you think of Rome and anything to do with, like, gladiators and everything else. Like, there's chiseled men and beautiful women, and that's it. The show probably could have done better, but that's just what it seems
to be. Yeah, I find it doesn't set the scene as well as Deadwood sets the scene.
I mean, we're spending time with the very top of Roman. Most of our time we're spending with the very top of Roman society. I mean, there is Varinus's wife who, yes, looks like a person who, you know, isn't crawling with lice and has half of her teeth, as was probably accurate. Although, you know, I don't know that I would say that. I do think that the Romans had a pretty good handle on hygiene, as far as the running water of it and the irrigation of it, which is, you know, like a very important, if not the most important part of like sewage and just the general cleanliness of your population is how much water is running through at any given time. Are there corpses in the street? 100%. I don't think it's like medieval times where everyone is caked in shit.
Right, in bread and shit. This is a big cross-section of different cultures even.
Yeah, this the whole world of the Mediterranean, at least, if not even further out than that, is funneling into Rome.
So you look at the guys that are at the bar or gambling club, Bill's Gambling Hall there with Titus Pullo.
Sure.
And those are some ugly dudes.
Yeah, like it's rough as shit there. And in the brothels, too, I can't even imagine. But
right, but then even like Caesar's guys out in Gaul, like they don't even look dirty. They've been there 8 years, no running water. There's not much dirt. Like Anthony shows up in blood. He's like, "Oh, just leave it. Don't wash your face off."
Right. He made a show of that.
Right. Do you think the guys in the 13th Legion have washed their faces every day?
I mean, all right, fair enough. Who knows? Maybe the beauties of arsenic are something that we've lost track of due to how deadly toxic it is.
I did notice they just kind of dropped that line in there. I wasn't really sure.
Yeah, and like
trying to explain the history behind it or something.
All the clothes are dyed in piss, and I feel like there's another deadly chemical that comes up. If maybe it's not lead, but like another one that they use to beautify themselves. Who knows? I mean, maybe I take everything back that I just said. Because, again, all the clothes are dyed in piss.
Well, I like, although they talk about their makeup and stuff, and the daughter, can they rename?
Octavia.
When they actually put her in all that makeup, and she just looks... She
looks bad. Looks awful. She looks far worse than she does without the makeup.
So they need to hire Sophia's makeup lady. That's all I know.
Speaking of the man that... Octavia is trying to seduce in that woman of horrible makeup. Pompey Magnus is the antagonist to Caesar at this point in the series. A guy who's had his day in the sun, probably the most famous person in Rome after Caesar at this point. Although, depending on what day of the week it is, that might flip-flop. He annihilated some pirates. He was the one who put the final nail in the coffin of Spartacus, of the Spartacus uprising. He took over Spain. He's a huge military badass. And his position at the moment, which he shares with Caesar, is consul. Consul is essentially like the co-president in that they have executive power over the Senate, where they can veto stuff. If there is a war to fight, they are the commanders-in-chief of the various legions. He represents the establishment, whereas Caesar represents like the up and coming downtrodden people of Rome. And like that's just the axis that they're resting on at this moment. And as these three episodes go on, Caesar's in the ascendant. The way to Rome is clear. And even though Pompey has more people, they're spread out all over his various territories, whereas Caesar, his men seem to be closer. Yeah, and he's got the city now.
It's like a game of Risk, and Caesar's like in South America or Australia.
Sure.
Australia before they nerfed it.
Pompey's got solid armies in the Urals, and he's got South Africa, and he's got Siam.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
A lot of tanks there.
Yeah.
But it's going to be hard to unite them all up. That's some solid Risk. Solid Risk, Doc.
Speaking of our new Risk podcast.
Like I said, I don't really want to dwell on the plot too much going forward in these recaps. Just talking about the characters and what they're doing and going from there. But before we move on to our handful of segments, does anyone want to single anything out from the plot? Developments, scenes, whatever, before we move on?
I'd like to know who wins in a fight between the Optimates and the Ambulators.
Games. The Optimates are old men, so I would like the Ambulators win.
Yeah, they got their ass beat in the Senate. That wasn't going well for them.
That is fantastic.
I got a thing with the plot. The only thing that really bothered me was the cart at the end.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they find the oxen cart, and they look at it, and they chase everybody away from it, kill them except for the one guy, and then they don't go back to get it. Like, why? I didn't understand that. So then they send the one guy, goes back and looks at it.
Well, Veronis
to find it later.
Says that
he says we have orders.
Right. He said we proceed, and that's his whole character, though, is that he's loyal to the 13th and to Caesar, so he's given a direct order to do something, and nothing was stopping him.
Yeah, right. It just seemed really dumb.
It should bother you. He doesn't go back, but that's his character flaw.
Right.
And then later,
that really
Pula goes back for the girl and just happens to find what's in the car.
Yeah. Right. And then Caesar is marching to an abandoned Rome, the capital of the earth at this moment, and sees a cart nearby and nothing else for miles and doesn't even send a single guy over to look at the cart.
Well, why would he? I mean, you see them.
Yeah, it's like it's priorities.
Because he's got someone who's farming.
It's just a cart full of grain.
You notice that Caesar made it specific. He said, we are not pillaging. We're not robbing people.
That's also true.
We're not going off of what we're doing here because we are.
I'm just saying, if it's the only human they've seen for miles and miles,
I don't think that's the only human. Into. Like, do you remember the scene where they drive by the boy just fishing in the river, just walk by him?
Right. They at least wink at him.
It could be Mark Anthony's kid.
Pulo does, sure.
No, it was Mark Anthony winked at him.
Mark Anthony winked, yes, that is correct.
Yeah, I've always thought that like, it might have been his kid since there's so much time.
Because so much time passes. Yeah.
Before he had sex with that one chick.
It's been 5 years.
Yeah. So.
Yeah, but how much time passes? Mark. I mean, with the time thing, I mean, they said they were 30 miles outside of Rome, and they're like, he's 3 days away.
Two days. Yeah. 30 miles was 2 days.
Yeah. So it should bother you he didn't look for that cart, and I think that's part of Varinus' character, and I think that's the point.
Yeah.
It should bother you.
And I think the most important thing on this specific mission is that he wants to get it over with as soon as possible so he can stop the sacrilege and not sin anymore by taking an army into Rome, which, as we'll talk a little later, is a great sin in the morality. Politics and religion are tied so tightly together, like the equivalent act of not releasing one's tax returns when they're running for president would be something that you would need to go to a temple and sacrifice a bunch of doves or goats or oxen or whatever to cleanse that, to get the gods back on your side.
For example, just an example.
Just a totally nonsensical, never would happen example that I'm just making up off the top of my head. So our first segment, which again, hopefully we can beat. Time makes no sense in Rome. I feel like we can at least cut 3 words out of it.
Oh, is this why you wore that shirt today with a messed up clock on it?
See, you would know if we decided to talk about the better show, which I would say is Hannibal.
Oh, that clock's from Hannibal?
It is from Hannibal, yes.
So Hannibal has messed up time, too.
Hannibal, the time in Hannibal more or less makes sense.
There's things that don't make sense, but time
does. Of course not, but that's what makes the show great.
Which one of our podcasts said that serial killers didn't exist until people had free time?
That was very recently. I think that was Shane. That's
probably me, Brian.
That was Shane. We're watching a show where Titus Pullo personally has probably killed like 1,000 people at this point in his life. Okay, so time makes no sense in Rome. There's going to be repeated examples of this, and we're just going to put signposts on to the characters that don't have like historical records of them. All these historical things are going to be happening around them, but they're not necessarily going to age. So one of those things is establishing the age of Varinus's daughters. We figure out in this episode that Varinus married Niobe when she was 13, and their oldest daughter is now the same age. Okay, that's all perfectly fine.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it makes perfect sense, as I put in the notes.
Yes, in 49 BC, which is the year presently in the series at the end of episode 3.
We're going to segue to Brian's moment of science. The first thing, so it starts off with his wife at the time dies during childbirth. And maybe you can answer this as history buffs for me. The number of older men fathering children, that presents a whole host of genetic and birthing complications, right?
Well, from what I understand, it's not as prevalent as people think. Like, studies have shown that, yes, there's some things that might be associated, but like the odds aren't as great as people seem to fear, if that makes sense.
I mean, how many old
guys? Well, I mean, I think that fear is new to where it used to be non-existent.
Well, yeah, it used to just be the woman's fault.
Yes.
I'm saying science now says it's not as big a deal as people first thought it was when it became a thing.
It's impossible to say where that's going to go when, like, I don't know. I feel like just as the age of birth gets older and older, we'll just know more about it.
Well, people are born the same age every time.
Thank you, Shane. What did I say?
As the age parents, of birth.
That's not exactly true, though. I mean, people aren't born the same age.
There's your
9 months, there's 8 months, 7 months of the womb. Sure.
Oh, well, you want to get that literal, Bobby? Listen, I had a perfectly little joke going in, and you just go and out literal me.
Literal Bobby.
As the age of parents having
it's too late, John. You cannot
time,
walk it back. You've proven yourself a fool.
We'll know more and more about the relationship between various illnesses and abnormalities.
Between this and your viruses aren't alive talk, everyone knows you're a sham of science, man.
Viruses aren't alive. I feel like that is self-evident.
And back to point number two on our moment of science. Can we talk about how great the surgery drill was when
that
was
fantastic.
Digging into his head.
That whole scene is excellent.
It's one of those little things like when they got into like mining in Deadwood where you're seeing like pools of the time. I think those things are fantastic.
Although I like how it ends. Like you have this big science moment where like medicine-wise this is a big deal. But then and the doctor's like, yeah, don't forget to like have him pray or sacrifice this.
Yes.
Yeah.
And he might never wake up. But, you know, whatever.
Bob, my historical companion, he made me pause it at this moment in the episode and let me know that doctors, that was actually a very low dignity position in Rome, probably because they thought everything was so causal in the sense of this is not because you're sick necessarily or because there is an infection or whatever. It's because you didn't sacrifice the right number of doves to the right god. And here we're going to come to our next segment titled, Romans Are Just Like Us. Holy shit, these people are superstitious. From the top to the bottom, everyone is all about sacrificing, praying to the right God at the right moment. And whether you do or you don't, as I just said, that dictates the course of your day. Per Kaiser, back in 2006, if you were a very reverent person, you wouldn't be able to get out of your bedroom without saying a prayer to probably 10 to 15 different gods. For example, Titus Pullo, right, when he is in jail in the pilot, he prays to Forculus, who is the god of doors. But it doesn't work because he doesn't also pray to the god of hinges, which is a real thing. So you can't just pray to God of doors. You gotta get the hinges too, or otherwise it's not gonna work.
I think they do the best religious part with this with Titus Pullo, who just prays to any and all gods at all times, and just like whatever. Yeah. Throw a spaghetti at a wall, someone's gonna stick.
Here's a naked guy standing next to this shrine in this brothel zone, in the brothel zone. I'm gonna blow some fire at it. And it's gonna make my dick hard.
The brothel zone. I feel like that's gotta be something like the brothel zone. Like that's like some sort of show when ESPN originally came out. Like we're at the brothel zone here in Amsterdam for this specific contest.
It's a different time.
Pullo is like whatever. I'm gonna throw a spear at the wall. Varinus is like very specific, and he knows what you're supposed to do. He's a good little Catholic. And then Mark Anthony's just like, fuck it, none of this matters.
Well, I mean,
but I just like how we have three characters who are making a statement on Roman religion, and I think it's good. I think it's good writing for that.
Yes.
Obviously, early on in the season.
You mentioned being a good Catholic. I don't think it is any accident that Catholicism found a root in Rome, because, wow, I hadn't made this connection before, but just the roots for Catholic guilt are so deeply sown into these people. Yeah. Like everything is on purpose. Everything is deserved. Just, you know, funnel all your 100 gods into one god and just make it easier. Part two in Romans Are Just Like Us. Shane, you mentioned that Mark Antony goes through the motions, but he is not a believer. this is also a big part of these first three episodes, and a nice little connection between Rome and where we are right now, in that all this stuff is only valuable if everyone agrees that it's valuable. Pompey spends so much of these first three episodes complaining about Caesar. It's not the war season. You can't break these taboos. I can't believe he's doing this when he's spending all this time complaining when he should be thinking up how to counter him. What is that? What could that possibly remind us of? Where, you know, we spend all this time talking about institutions and how things are done and not done, and like, holy shit, I can't believe all this is working. I can't believe all this is working so well for people that don't give a shit.
I know the answer.
About how things have been done for so long.
You're talking about Mel Gibson's movie The Patriot.
Yes.
Where the British guys complain about the swamp fox.
Yeah. Right? It was always available for someone to stab a horse with the flag.
Yeah.
But someone had to think of it.
Yeah. Mel Gibson did it. And also they just hid in the woods and shot people instead of just lining up to be shot.
Sure. Yeah. There's some kind of honor attached. I can't believe we're talking about the Patriot. There's some kind of honor attached to just standing in a line shooting guns at each other, but there's a greater value in hanging on to your life.
We actually did a game at Brian's bachelor party. Oh, what we call it? We called it
Civil War.
We just sat in line. It was like everyone's running low on the paintball ammunition. And we just sat there. We all fired one shot. If you got hit, it didn't explode. You had to keep walking, which is like a punishment more than a victory.
You had to take one step forward, and then we all fired on both sides.
Yes. That went really well.
That's what you do with your last 15.
After the first shot or two, we learned to turn sideways even.
Yeah.
I feel like
it was probably a disgrace.
That's really not the spirit of the Civil War game, it sounds like. I don't know. Did Johnny Reb think of that?
Turn sideways.
To get it back to politics, I don't know. Pat Buchanan has his giant heart on about comparing America to Rome at every opportunity, except he's more about like the fall of the empire. But the fall of the Republic is just as instructive. It was this tremendous society that was the center of the world and dominant, and it just tore itself apart for really interesting reasons. So our last segment, which again, let's see if we can't beat it, is Rome is an alien civilization. I mentioned the crucifixion earlier and the genocide of the Gauls and how this is on no one's mind. Just the application of cruelty as like a civic virtue I've heard it like some kind of parable where like if animals could talk and speak in English, we still wouldn't be able to make ourselves understood to them and they to us, because our understanding of the world is just completely alien to each other. And I feel like that's more or less the same thing with like a post-Enlightenment Western world with a Roman antiquity sense of what is valuable and what isn't, and what is where peer pressure comes from and what it's trying to get a person to do, and the values that society places on human life and human value. They would think that we were weak morons, and we would think they're evil brutes to a man.
Yeah, I mean, the value of life is zero, right? Just about.
More or less. I mean, there are slaves everywhere, but slavery is, it's not a permanent part of your life. Like, if you can survive it, you can get out of it. But if you get out of it, you did it on purpose. And if you died, you did that on purpose too. And when I say died, I mean your master killed you in a fit of pique. That's your fault. That's got nothing to do with the master. You fucked up in some way.
How far removed is civilization from that, honestly?
Well, here's a good example. Niobe, she is able to convince Varinus that the baby that she had with her brother-in-law is actually Varina the Elder's baby. And everyone else knows this. But if Varinus finds out, he is, I wouldn't necessarily say legally required, but certainly like socially required to kill his whole family, including his daughters, just to cleanse the stain of this cuckolding from his life. And if he doesn't do that, he's a piece of shit as far as anyone else is concerned.
It's unfortunate that there are still places that are like that, and cultures are like that.
Right, and that's what I'm saying. I'm not saying
I don't think it's that I don't think it's that extreme. I don't think you have to kill the whole family. There are,
I'm not
there
get,
are
I'm not
no question.
That.
Why not? There are no question honor killings in the world, but the rest of the, but at least that sin is localized in one person,
even though
it's obviously not a sin. The idea of treating individuals as a male lion would treat his pride, I do not think is something that exists in the world anywhere right
you're
now.
You're incorrect. I'm not going to talk about it here.
Yeah, but let's stick up for those people.
No, it's not sticking up for those people. It's sticking up against super lefty assholes.
Who yeah, bring it. Fuck them. Who cares?
I know, fuck them, but I'm not going to give them the fucking ammo. I'll tell you
who's they? Is Above Average Fan Dave one of them?
Because he's the only one listening.
I'm not going to put it in the air.
Hey, Dave.
Oh. No, I won't do it. I won't.
If Blair was with us, she would say that Christianity fit itself very nicely into this niche of finding the value in every person, slave or free or Roman or not. And I think that's wholly accurate because, I don't know, like these people are bathing in cruelty at every opportunity. And it's just ripe for a different way to see the world.
Yeah, there's something, I mean, certainly there's definitely something to that as far as early Christians were, for the before this really grew, they weren't having kids, they were pretty abstinent, and so the ones who really started adopting dregs in the worst of society because their numbers need to go up.
And this society has a lot of dregs.
It has a lot of dregs, yes. And those are the lives who are worth the least, so... It's like wins above replacement from baseball, right?
I don't know
yeah.
what you're talking about.
So, yeah. Lucius Varinas is, you know, is probably
– we're going to talk about sports.
He's a solid above average.
Let's talk about youth basketball.
Oh, damn it.
I heard Shane lost.
He did. Shane lost 29-27 to the Purple Unicorns, coached by yours truly, John Kissel. It was a pretty glorious win, I guess.
Shane, team's name.
Just green, just the green team.
You're just right. Green. That's why Kissel won. It's the Purple Unicorn.
Right. No, you're right. My team
deserved the win.
I agree completely. For a lot of reasons.
My team was indecisive the other day, and we won the fourth quarter because we were too indecisive the other quarters, and just did not attack in it. This team, I'm getting to know them. I might have to be a little more aggressive on defense, get our offense going.
Me and my team, we are in sync. 100% in sync. I feel like we're gonna run the league now.
They got an eighth grader who's a floor general. I mean, he's great. He's in charge, and he has them keep him calm. And I do not have.
I was missing three players. Shane was missing two.
Yeah. So who knows what it's gonna look like? I was definitely missing my 5'11" point guard, which is massive for middle school. another my really smart the kid's dad works at the CDC, so like when I drew up a play, like he was the first person to understand it for our zone offense. He's like, oh yeah, coach, just like this, and then I do this. I'm like, God bless you. You have good genetics.
There was some concern about the 3-2 against everyone's dumb 2-3 that they run in this league, including the elementary school, but I was right to go with it. And we're sticking with it going forward.
You should.
Yes. 3-2. Okay. 3-2.
So we practice against all the time. I mean,
scrimmage is not a reliable.
27 is not a lot for a middle school age to score. And neither is 29. And no, I feel pretty good about my defense. I feel great about my high school defense. It only allowed 15 points. And like 7 of those came in a 2-minute stretch.
We're talking about middle school.
So
where you were,
you're
humiliated.
Right, when I was defeated.
We're also not talking about elementary school, where we were both humiliated.
Yes,
our team lost 21-4.
Yeah,
I don't have any idea how to coach 3rd through 5th graders. So Rome, good start to the season. I enjoy this show. It's not. I don't think I'm gonna like have it in my top 10 all timer or anything. But you know, for a brief period. It was one of the best shows on TV.
I this is the show when people ask me, like, when people are like, what show should I watch? I've watched like all the big ones, right? This is something for everyone, I feel like. There's a little bit of violence, but it's not overly done. And there's enough like soap opera stuff as well. And there's political stuff. So it's like it's a non-magical Game of Thrones, really, I think.
I think it's deeper. Like Game of Thrones has moments where you can like look, you can look at your phone and miss nothing. I've had to pause Rome more times in the first three episodes than any other TV show just to write stuff down, because I'll write a sentence down and miss a whole bunch in 15 seconds. It's absurd.
If that's the comparison, I absolutely think Rome, and this is aided by like things that actually happened, more or less, again, like who really knows. Rome has like a coherent political philosophy compared to Game of Thrones, which we'll see. I kind of doubt it.
I don't think Rome would be a good show in the age of social media, because not enough people can live tweet what's going on, because you'd miss too much stuff.
I mean,
I was wondering that, like, what it would be if it was a show now with the money they know they can spend and make.
Yeah,
I think it might actually benefit them to like stretch things out, because like the first time you meet the two guys that you remember, Bobby, what are their names?
Varinus and Pullo.
They attack that, you know, wagon that had the eagle on it. They just like. They're there, the wagon, everyone's dead, and it took like 8 seconds. It wasn't Game of Thrones where we would have listened to them talk for a minute and then watched a 3-minute battle.
Loot train? Then,
yeah, and then 2 minutes of the kid. Like it was, the whole scene was maybe 30 seconds total.
Yeah, and that opening battle too that starts the series off, like you have a sense of how they fight and why they're effective. But there is like a 1 second frame of like a wider shot. It's just like 12 guys on the Roman side and a bunch of like bearded Gauls racing at them. It's a tiny scene.
I think you're right. I could see this first three episodes being stretched out to almost an entire season, honestly.
Yes.
I would love that because I love these characters so much. I'm trying to think if there's a character I do not care for. And I don't know if they're...
Natia is a lot.
She is a lot.
She's also the only one who's ever nominated for anything, Polly Walker.
Strangely enough. That kind of thing. Kieran Hines, I think, really, really brought it home in this first season.
Are we gonna do best lines in Deadwood fashion? Can I have...
We can. I mean, we can. Like, Mark Antony. Mark Antony in that premiere when he... asked Varinus how he would find the eagle, and Varinus tells him, and he replies, "We are of a mind." I love that. I love that just little phrase.
I have Atia here, and in Evansville style, she says, "What a cadre of heroes, such vim."
Yes, I know. I knew you were gonna say something about that. Vim.
I don't understand.
My memorable choir. Quote, though, I was thinking the one where I don't know his name, but one of the guys in the Senate was like, "What a dreadful noise these plebs make when they're happy." Just wait till you hear them, or like whenever Caesar starts, you know, asking for our blood, wait till you hear him then.
I do. That is a very good line. And that leads me. I don't have a line because I know we're doing that. But I'm just going to nominate the guy with the jowls who announces everything in Rome all the time.
Sure, yes. Yes. The ad man.
Julius Augustus Caesar says.
It's the best bread. True bread for true Romans.
Oh, man.
That'll do us for this introductory episode of our Rome recap. We'll be back in 2 weeks, give or take, with the next three episodes. And I don't know, depending on how that goes, depending on the density, it's not going to, I mean, the show's not going to get more slow and take its time anymore. We may knock it down to 2 episodes per podcast. I don't know. It's up to you guys. There are only 22 episodes, so we'll get through it fast no matter what. We just recently released a best of movies for the year of 2013 or 2017. That should be going through your feeds right at this moment, and we'll have more podcast episodes coming through about the best of TV and another one about the best of movies as well. And we are also continuing on in our latest trio of movies, the theme most recently being 2017 catch-up wide release movies. Split is out. Great Wall is going to be written tonight, and Megan Levy will be followed up after that. And then we'll also have a podcast about that in the future as well. Anybody watch Split yet? You jerks.
I saw the reviews and I'm like,
I'm an outlier.
I watched the whole thing.
I heard good things, but here, this is a couple months ago. I went to watch Split on my Amazon Fire Stick. And when I hit it, a bowling movie came up, even though like it was
twist.
The Avatar was the M. Night Shyamalan movie, right? But the bowling movie came up, and so I watched it anyway. Yeah, it's a bowling movie called Split, and it's just like romantic.
Right. Well, I think you identified the problem.
Right, and it's like this romantic comedy, and actually a girl I went to high school is in it, because she's a bowler. But it's rubbish. I watched the whole thing. I felt like I had to.
That's not the movie that we'll be discussing in a couple weeks.
Maybe you can get that one in the next theme.
Yeah, maybe.
So I'll try
bowling
again.
Movies that are named after other movies.
Actually, we could probably do that. Movies with Bobby's former classmates. Definitely.
Sure. He went to school with Rami Malek. Yeah. He was in The Master. I mean, you know, that'd be a great mediocre movie.
There's plenty to choose from other than that.
I could write so many pages.
Beat my head against the wall on that one, like you guys in the movie.
Yeah, nice done.
Like us on Facebook at Mutica Movie Club. Follow us check us out on the internet at MutikaMovie.club, Twitter, MutikaMovieCall, iTunes reviews, Amazon link on the website, all that fun stuff. That'll do us for this episode of the Mutica Movie Club podcast. Thank you for joining me tonight.
Nice, John.
See ya.
Have a good night.